This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Civil rights lawyers Morris Dees and Joseph Levin Jr. founded the Southern Poverty Law Center in 1971. Since then, the civil rights organization has battled white supremacist groups through the courts. Today, the SPLC continues its work through the legal system, focusing on children's rights, economic and immigrant justice, LGBT rights, and criminal justice reform. The SPLC also monitors and tracks a wide variety of hate and extremist organizations throughout the U.S. While the SPLC has identified many extremist hate groups, it has been criticized for some of the organizations and individuals it's included on that list. Southern Poverty Law Center co-founder Joseph Levin Jr. was recently in Cincinnati to meet with area leaders. He and Jackie Conjado, director of the Jewish Community Relations Council with the Jewish Federation of Cincinnati, came into our studios to talk with WVXU politics reporter Howard Wilkinson.
Welcome. Thank you for being here today.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Mr. Levin, you've been involved, obviously. You were one of the founders, co-founders of Morris Dees of the Southern Poverty Law Center back in 1971, which is an era where we were just coming out of the civil rights struggles of the 60s, but there were still an awful lot of problems back in those days with racism, and particularly in the South. Tell me a little bit about the genesis of this organization, what it was for, and how that purpose relates to today.
Of course, in the late 60s and the early 70s, the civil rights movement to some degree had been diminished by what was going on in this country with respect to Vietnam. And it was a concern of Dr. King's before he was assassinated. He had spoken out against the war, and I think that was in part because it was not only because he felt that it was not a war that we should be engaged in. Americans were dying. It was also, again, diminishing the civil rights movement. We'd had the Voting Rights Act passed, the Civil Rights Act passed, and all of a sudden, the country was so focused on Vietnam that those issues were not getting the attention that they needed, that they deserved. And so here we arrive in the late 60s with protests going on all over the country having to do with the war and very little attention being paid to civil rights issues. Morris Dees and I, it's a long story, but we met. We started a law firm in, as I recall, the late 60s, early 70s. And we were doing both private practice, but most of what we did was civil rights litigation. And this was in an era before lawyers could get attorney's fees for successful prosecution of civil rights cases. So we couldn't support the law firm with the civil rights cases that we were bringing and wanted to bring, which had to do primarily back in the day, we're talking now, late 60s, early 70s, had to do with sex and race discrimination, primarily race discrimination. So we made a decision to start a nonprofit, the Southern Poverty Law Center. We founded that in June of 1971, and we continued cases. We'd already begun. We went out to the general public through direct mail saying, here's what we're doing, and we need your support. And we were successful in doing that. We got a good response. And in the early years, we filed lawsuits against George Wallace's state trooper force to desegregate the force. In the early 70s, it was still an all-white state trooper's force. We sued the state the U.S. District Judge at that time, the very famous Frank M. Johnson, Jr., found in our favor and ruled that the state troopers had to desegregate and hire one black trooper for every white trooper until 25% of the force was black. We also filed a major case against the state of Alabama to reapportion the state legislature, which in that day had one black legislator in the entire state. within a couple of years, there were, I think, 17 black legislators. So that reapportionment helped. But those are the kinds of cases. We also did a number of sex discrimination cases. Yeah.
But this, it was formed basically as a mechanism to fund these lawsuits, to be able to pursue these issues in court.
Yes.
Because you weren't getting fees in those cases.
Right. There was no money available, certainly not from our clients, and the federal government did not pass the law that provided attorney's fees for successful civil rights litigation until 1975.
Now, today, Southern Poverty Law Center is thought of, I think, mostly as an organization which tracks hate groups or white supremacist groups, other groups that advocate discrimination. Is that the case now? Is that the focus of the organization?
That is a large focus of what we do.
Yeah.
And, of course, that's the element of our mission which gets the most attention. Mm-hmm. But we also have lots of other elements of our litigation program that deal with not only that, still race discrimination, sex discrimination, discrimination against the LGBT community. We have a project that operates away from our headquarters in Montgomery in Atlanta, our Immigrant Justice Project, which was started initially to deal with immigration issues, the way immigrants were treated, particularly in the Southeast and the agricultural and timber industries. And, of course, today, given the current climate, we've expanded that significantly. Juvenile justice work across the South. We have a teaching tolerance program that's national in scope, providing materials to schools, public and private, all across the country. So the Intelligence Project, which deals with what you just referenced, that is hate groups, the rise of extremism in the country, investigating and documenting what we've observed in that arena, that's the one particularly since the beginning of, I'd say, somewhere in the middle of 2015, where this has become such an issue, it's gotten a great deal of attention.
Has it become an issue because there are many more of these groups, or just many more individuals who are aligning themselves, you know, through the internet or whatever, with hate groups?
It's become an issue because then candidate for president Donald Trump became what at least one white supremacist has called a gateway drug for these groups. His attacks on immigrants, his attacks on Muslims, on Mexicans, and other Hispanics, the way in which he conducted himself throughout the campaign basically gave license to these people to come out in the open in ways that, first of all, that I have never observed, despite the fact that I grew up in the Deep South, but in ways that were similar but more overt than what I grew up with. And I grew up in an era of the Ku Klux Klan. We're talking now about the late 40s and 50s into the 60s in Alabama. The Ku Klux Klan, the White Citizens Council, which is the parent organization to today's Council of Conservative Citizens, which is we've identified as a hate group, and you see that throughout the South. But that's what's happened. We've seen what people like Richard Spencer, white supremacist, and other white supremacists have identified as a validation of their work. A guy named Matthew Heimbach, who leads a white supremacist group that does a lot of work on college campuses, referred to Trump as and I think this might be the most cogent description I've heard, as a gateway drug to white supremacy. That is what we've seen, and we've seen it all the way from mid-2015, whenever he announced, all the way up to, of course, and including Charlottesville and the after effects of Charlottesville.
Let's talk about Charlottesville for a moment. We all know what happened there. And Richard Spencer and a number of other white supremacists converged on that town, and people who were in opposition to them also converged, and there was a lot of violence, and some terrible things happened. The president's response to that was, there are good people on both sides of this.
He said some very fine people
were associated with
the neo-Nazis and the white supremacists.
On both sides of this confrontation.
He didn't say very fine people were on the other side. He said it was just on the neo-Nazi white supremacist side.
Okay. What did that do in terms of just breathing life into this?
It simply reinforced the notions that already existed within the white supremacist community, that they have the leader of the free world on their side. They said that. They took it that way. You heard it from people like Richard Spencer, David Duke. That's the way they interpreted it. They liked it.
Mm-hmm. Jackie, what about here locally? I mean, we've seen some incidents here directed at not only the Jewish community, but the Muslim community. Acts of not personal violence, but graffiti and that sort of thing, destruction of property. What do you think the situation is here?
I think we certainly at the Jewish Community Relations Council are made aware daily of not only what's happening locally and incidents that come up, but nationally the reports that we're getting from groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ADL and from our partners in law enforcement who track these sorts of things. And people ask all the time if there's been an increase. I think at this point we can say that, you know, we have seen certainly more of these. You know, I think we owe it to ourselves to think about where we've been and what was happening prior to the election, what existed out there prior to any of the candidate fields sort of shaping up, and whether these groups feel emboldened is certainly another question. But I think the bigger problem for us as Cincinnatians, for us as Americans, is to try and understand how we can address the underlying issue, which is larger numbers of people coming out, whether it's online or in person, in favor or in support of some of this hatred, regardless of what political party. I think there's an underlying issue that's been bubbling for a long time. And that's really what's incumbent upon us as leaders in the community to band together to confront and to try and figure out how to proactively educate more, how to proactively, should I say, push this back to the margins. I think that's really important.
Mr. Lem, a lot of the acts that have taken place here, where there have been attacks on synagogues, on mosques, they've been perpetrated by individuals. Individuals who are presumably on the internet and in some kind of communication with some of these hate groups. Is that the problem? I mean, that you've got all of these basically individuals out there who are just running around committing these acts with no direction, no central authority. They're just picking all this stuff up off of the internet.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. While we document organized hate groups around the country,
mm-hmm.
There is the web, and there are people, and the best illustration of that is Dylann Roof, who murdered the 9 black churchgoers in South Carolina. He was not a person who was affiliated with or had any physical contact with any white supremacist or neo-Nazi group of any sort. His motivation came entirely from the web. That's where it came from. That's what caused him to, as he put it, start a race war. That's what he wanted to do. That's one illustration. There are many others, and that's one of the bigger issues, trying to get a handle on what these groups are doing on the web, what they're saying on the web, try to control what goes on the web to some degree. You see that playing out now, whether we're talking about Facebook or Twitter or Google. all kinds of discussion about algorithms and how things turn up. It's a big deal.
It seems like almost an impossible task, though. I mean, it's so big and so pervasive on the internet that how do you keep up with it?
Well,
you certainly can't keep up with all the individuals who are looking at it.
No
inspiration.
No, you can't, and it is an extraordinarily difficult task. It is not an impossible task. The companies that provide the platforms can do something about it. We've seen them do something about it already. We've seen the two biggest neo-Nazi websites, Daily Stormer and Stormfront, having great difficulty finding platforms for their bigotry. I mean, they'll find them. They've worked around it. They'll get back up. They'll go. But those can be controlled to some degree, but they're going to pop back up. They're not going to disappear. So is it impossible to stop them completely? Of course. But is it impossible to gain some control and at least draw the line to some degree? No, that can be done. And we actually see Congress now taking an interest in that kind of thing. And so I think you're going to see over time some controls out there. Now, if you're not talking about a website that is overtly white supremacist or neo-Nazi, but you're talking about, the best illustration is Steve Bannon and Breitbart. Bannon took Breitbart, which was a very conservative website, and he turned it into basically a platform for white supremacists. Those were his commentators, the people who came in, commented, their editors. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I think it's Shapiro. Very conservative guy, was an editor at Breitbart, who came out and basically said that Bannon had created a platform for anti-Semites and racists. It's not just the platforms that are so overtly encouraging, I'll call it violence, again, Stormfront, Daily Storm, and it's not just those. It's some that are extreme, but they haven't quite crossed that line. But they get that kind of commentary. That, to me, is a more problematic issue.
That's an interesting question, because I know, you know, and you're aware of this, I'm sure, that, you know, there is criticism of your organization sometimes that you cast too broad a net in terms of what you define as a hate group. The Family Research Council advocates for a certain position. And it's a position that, you know, says same-sex marriages are wrong. And they have radio shows. They have an internet presence. They're everywhere. Why is that a hate group?
It's a hate group not because they have a religious belief that homosexuality is biblically wrong. Mm-hmm. That's not it.
And that's what they say.
It's because – well, they do say that, but that's not all they say. They demonize the LGBT community. They talk about – Tony Perkins and others talk about how gays are more likely to be pedophiles than straight folks. They point to garbage research that they say makes that true. It's the demonization of that community that makes them a hate group, not some religious position that the Bible believes this, that, or the other. It's not that. It's the way in which they present it and the false information that they convey to their audience.
But they do have a right to speak out their religious beliefs, their position on these issues.
Oh, they have a right to speak out, period. I mean, there is a First Amendment. They can say pretty much what they want to say, as long as it's not something that, as long as they're not shouting fire in a crowded theater, right. And doing something that is clearly about to precipitate violence. Sure, they're entitled to their opinion. Richard Spencer is entitled to his opinion. All these people are entitled to their opinions. It does not mean that what they do and what they say doesn't constitute hate.
Tell me, from your organization's standpoint, what is the definition of a hate group? What is a hate group?
typically a hate group is one that goes after another particular group on the base for an immutable characteristic, such as race, or and we treat religion, being Jewish, as an immutable characteristic in that respect. So it's racist. It's anti-Semitic. But it's that immutable characteristic, Hispanic, right? How did Trump start his campaign? Blasting Mexicans as rapists. It's that kind of group. Beyond that, when we're talking again, as I explained earlier, about the LGBT community, your sexual identity is an immutable characteristic. And it's one thing to have some biblical position about gay marriage not being biblically approved. It's another thing to demonize that community and talk about it as attempting to take over the schools of our country and turn our children into homosexuals and to become pedophiles, which is exactly what you hear from groups like the FRC. So those are the groups that we look at, we investigate, and we identify them as hate groups. I can remember, and historically it's true, that the Bible was used as a basis for race discrimination. That in the Bible, according to those who were segregationists and supporters of Jim Crow, that was a biblically supported position to take. Mm-hmm. And even though the Southern Poverty Law Center does not identify groups that aren't going beyond that and aren't demonizing a particular group in some way, pedophilia, for example, beyond that, my personal view is that it's just another form of bigotry. And justified by the Bible, and it leads to people like Roy Moore in Alabama.
Do you see a real explosion in a number of these groups in the last few years?
Yes. Our most recent count of hate groups, which would be for the year 2016, showed, if I recall correctly, I think the number was 917 hate groups that we identified across the country. But that was the second largest number of hate groups that we've identified in 30 years of counts.
How many of those are sort of chapters of larger organizations? Do you count them twice or three times or four times?
Yes. If they're an independent group, in other words, if you have a Ku Klux Klan organization in Alabama and you have one in Ohio, they're counted separately because they are separate groups. There are very few of these groups that are well organized in a national sense. They take the dogma and they create their own groups. You have 35 hate groups here in Ohio.
Just to wrap up this conversation, what is it that your organization can do in this atmosphere today that nobody else can do to try to stem this tide of hate?
I would not be so self-centered as to say that we do something that nobody else can do. What we can do is take the resources that we have and work with other groups like the ADL, for example, which are concerned about the same issues that we care about. Hate, discrimination, bigotry, we can deal with those. We have begun our immigrant justice project due to the various administrative orders and other issues that have arisen during the first few months of the Trump administration. We find undocumented immigrants who've been here for years and years being arrested, dumped into these detention centers all over the country. We can do something and are doing something about that. So it's an education. There's a lot to be done.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for being here.
Okay.
Thank
you.
Thank you.
WVXU Politics reporter Howard Wilkinson speaking with Southern Poverty Law Center co-founder Joseph Levin Jr. and Jackie Conjado, director of the Jewish Community Relations Council with the Jewish Federation of Cincinnati. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. You can find archives of our programs at WVXU.org. The producer for today's show was Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Dave Shermer. I'm Mark Haney. Design Build Cincy returns to Music Hall this month. The show is for professionals as well as anyone looking for new ideas. On the next Cincinnati edition, we'll get a preview of the show's exhibits, speaker series, and Over the Rhine architecture tours. We'll also talk with University of Cincinnati students whose award-winning design work will be on display at Design Build Cincy. That's on Cincinnati Edition, Wednesday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.